All right, thank you for coming this morning. I'm happy to be back here able to teach. I think I've developed a reputation at this point for just talking on cultural topics, so I'm just continuing that. But this summer I'm probably going to teach Sunday school again. If you would prefer that I teach on something, say, more strictly theological than cultural or apologetics related, I'd be interested in your feedback, but admittedly, whenever I'm allowed to teach on whatever I want, that's kind of the area I drift toward, because that's the area that's of most personal interest to me, so it's very applicable. And this particular topic or talk wasn't inspired by any one event. It's just kind of been something that I've been mulling over in my mind for the past several years. When I was 18, maybe is when I started getting into politics or culture warfare, I guess you could say, as a young man. And I'm 34 now, and so I've seen in that time, that 16 years, there's even been a trend, and those who are older have seen a larger trend. But it's my opinion that Christians lost what we might call the culture war. And so I want to talk a little bit about why that is. And that does tie into apologetics some. It also ties into other topics like personal holiness and apathy and other kinds of misplaced emphasis or priorities in our lives. So hopefully it's of interest or value to you. One, I guess, launching point that comes to mind is this movie that was recently released, Unplanned. Maybe you could view this as a litmus test for where we are at culturally, but Unplanned is a movie about abortion. I don't actually know much about the plot. It's about someone named Abby Johnson, who I think worked at Planned Parenthood and then became pro-life. I would like to see it. Obviously, I have not. But it just interested me as a commentary on where we are in culture, that this movie, despite having no nudity, no sexual innuendo, no swearing, no rebellious or bad attitudes, simply because it was about abortion, it was still given an R rating to, I guess, dissuade people from seeing it, which I don't think has worked. I don't think it probably changed the box office revenue much, but it's just interesting is if you watch movies at all, and I don't watch a lot of movies, but I have noticed that what's considered PG-13 over the years, even since the 90s, is really changed. You know, something that's PG-13 now, like in the 90s, you would think that'd almost certainly be R-rated, and it's, you know, there's certain ways in which our perception of film and what can go into it and what children can be exposed to is shifting. But, you know, somebody talks about abortion and that's R-rated. So that really interested me. And I think that's an interesting barometer on where our culture is. And as always, if you have any questions or comments throughout the presentation, just raise your hand, and because I would love some interaction. So, why Christians lost the culture war? First of all, what do you think of when you hear the term culture war? I have not defined that yet, but depending on what circles you've run in, maybe politically or ministerially or anything else, images might come into your mind. For example, you might think of the Supreme Court decisions on, quote, gay marriage, unquote. Or you might think of people protesting for or against abortion, or another highly controversial incendiary topic. Or maybe, if you're a little bit older, you think about prayer in schools. Well, that's not even something this generation thinks about. That's kind of so far gone. That was lost so long ago. We'll talk a little bit more about that Yeah, and you can still pray in schools. Really, it should be more like routine prayer, you know, routine teacher-led prayer. Like somebody's still... Yeah, the school is not supposed to sponsor that type of prayer. When I gave a prayer at my high school graduation, actually the class prayer, and I just said, well, I'm going to pray in the name of Christ, and if somebody doesn't like it, then, you know, I've already graduated. What can they do? I'm never going to see those people again anyway. No, but I didn't care. But, yeah, obviously for a teacher, that'd be highly problematic. Or when you think of culture war, you might think of particular political individuals or organizations warring with one another. And so, you know, I could have listed a lot, but Family Research Council is one that I'm most familiar with. You might have also heard of American Family Association. There's Focus on the Family. There's the Alliance Defending Freedom, I think, or some of these more legal arms of the culture war movement, who will, you know, assist you in legal fees, legal aid, if you are involved in one of these major court battles relating to the culture war, like that baker in Colorado, I think, who was told to shut down because he was discriminating against a homosexual wedding. Southern Poverty Law Center, that's the group that goes around naming anything and everything a hate group if it's not ultra-progressive. Who's that guy in the middle? I actually got to hear him speak like 2 years before he passed away at Liberty University. I was raised on the East Coast, so I was somewhat near Virginia, for whatever that's worth. And then down in the bottom right, who's that?
Rick Santorum.
Yes, Rick Santorum. And he's a great example of a politician. Another one would be, I think, Gary Bauer, whose political platform was social issues, like moral issues, gay marriage, abortion, topics like that. Not so much the economy, not so much foreign affairs, although obviously he had opinions on those, but the platform was really, we are kind of the party, or I'm the politician of family values, I'm the politician that Christians or conservatives can feel safe voting for. And you see, I think, less and less of those types of politicians these days. And I'm not even saying any of these things are good, bad, or otherwise. I'm just giving you images to think about, or maybe to, you know, get the wheels turning, remind you. You might also think of just culture in general. Like I said, what's considered our nowadays? Or how often do people just use foul language? Like I was in Panera Bread in Cleveland trying to work, and there was like a group of teenagers at the table right next to me, and they were not even trying to hide or be quiet as they just used every, you know, filthy swear word in the book. And I was thinking, like, is there no shame? Like I'm not really prude. I don't personally swear, but I'm not super prudish about it. If I hear somebody swearing, I don't just like get up and walk away, unless they're using God's name in vain. That really bothers me. But like in this case, it was just so like selfish and shameless, and do you not care that anyone else is around you? Or just in general, teen rebellion. What is tolerable? What is okay for young people to do today? If somebody goes off and decides to, I don't know, even get their hair dyed or their lip pierced or whatever, or be, you know, change their dress, is that considered them just expressing themselves nowadays, or is it considered rebellion? Those kind of social mores and etiquette and things like that have changed. And I'm going to ask your opinion in a couple slides of what you think stands out to you as a barometer for how culture has changed. But another point I'm going to challenge us on is to not get too caught up in perceived barometers, because again, the point of us as Christians is not to return to a particular time period. Our goal is not to return to the 1950s or the 1800s or something like that, because they have their own major problems too. The point is to move forward to, I think, something that is more honoring to God. So what is the culture war? Here's how I define it. It's the struggle between ideological groups over the prevailing moral standards in a culture. And in America, we commonly view this as conservatism versus liberalism. I actually don't like either of those terms. I don't like the term conservative because it makes it sound like, again, like I just want to stick with something in the past. Well, no. I want us to follow God's word, which is true. I don't care that it's traditional. I don't care that it might have always been that way at some point, or it was general consensus. But nevertheless, the term conservative makes it sound like you're just this curmudgeon who just can't accept change and doesn't want to see change, and you know, you're just comfortable with the things as they always were. And you don't think outside the box, and that's not the heart of how I think a lot of us would view ourselves, if you even use that term, and I don't really use that term of myself. And then on the other hand is liberalism, another weird term, because the term literally refers to a promotion of freedom. Like liberalism 100 years ago, and even today still in Europe, refers to more free market attitudes, or attitudes that are, you know, oriented more toward less government regulation, smaller government. And if you Google the term classical liberal, that's still what that means. I mean, technically, I would call myself a classical liberal because I believe in rule of law. I believe in limited government. But the term liberalism in general has just morphed into mean progressivism, which is really weird. A lack of freedom, lots of regulation, or restraining people on how they can behave in certain areas, or intolerance. So another term I'm not a fan of, but that's common today. But as Christians, I think we should view the culture war more in terms of Christianity versus humanism. Christianity obviously being a worldview that looks to God for truth. And humanism, this general, all-encompassing worldview that looks to the human mind for truth. The human mind is the source of wisdom and knowledge, and that's what I talked about a lot last summer in the apologetics class I taught, that, you know, really at the end of the day, there's only two worldviews. There's one that believes that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and one that believes that you, me, whoever, culture, is the beginning of knowledge. And of course, the latter is irrational. So the culture war also has a strong association with what we could call Christian activism. And we're going to talk about that a little bit too, whether that's biblical, whether we do that too much, too little, etc. So what kind of moral standards? Well, if you think of what someone's worldview can encompass or touch on, which is literally anything, any part of their life, any part of things they might be interested in, then it can encompass many topics, laws, our laws and what we vote for, how we relate to other nations, what gets taught in school, both public and private. Art, music, film, what is considered art? What's considered good art, good music, good film? And then even technology, how is technology to be used? Any comments at this point? Any thoughts? Does anyone disagree with my definition or think it could be expanded? Yeah, I guess I was thinking that almost was the moral standard. But yeah, it will, other people who are, you know, some people who don't identify as a particular worldview. You know, they don't walk around saying, I am a humanist or I am a Christian. They're more vague about it. Yeah, that would make sense for them. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. That is the bedrock foundation. Cultures are dominated by worldviews. Mm-hmm. And the worldview of the West began shifting radically in the 19th century. And we're beginning to see it play out on the street level in our time. So unless you
can get
back and understand what's going on then, you don't really have an adequate grasp of what's going on now.
I agree. Yeah, I know you did the Bible study on how Christianity shaped the West and the prevailing worldview of the West for many centuries. I totally agree with that. And probably a lot of us have heard someone say that, like, you can look at Europe and see where the United States will be in 20 years or maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years. And, you know, that's true in a sense, because they began to sink. They began to succumb to, say, theological liberalism. Earlier, like Germany was where the Protestant Reformation began, and then in the early 19th century, that's where theological liberalism really took hold, or the idea that Christianity could just be a private moral religion, not something that we should impose upon others or should really affect all of culture. And then it wasn't until maybe 100 years later in the United States that started to take at least theological liberalism and the liberal Protestant denomination started to take a foothold.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I can remember when I was in high school hearing the Democratic Party continually say you can't legislate morality, you can't legislate. And that was their thing to beat down any kind of moral disagreement with mm-hmm. homosexuality or abortion or whatever. Now all you hear from the Democrats is it's immoral, it's immoral, it's immoral. So they beat us into their view of neutrality, and now they want to replace with their so-called mm-hmm. morality. So I find it very hypocritical and very interesting that that's such an argument from them right now about morality.
Yeah, I agree that there's a huge amount of hypocrisy in what a lot of politicians say. And on both sides or all sides, I know we tend to think of the United States as just two parties. It's a little more complicated than that, but and certainly I am very hesitant to identify myself as a Republican, even though I've typically voted that way, because, you know, let's be honest, the Republican Party has been massively disappointing in many regards. But and this is not meant to be a political talk either. I don't care really. I don't care how someone votes. I just think something like abortion is a non-negotiable. That's my opinion. Like I'll debate somebody till the cows come home on something like how much wealth there should be redistributed, how much the government should be involved in healthcare, things like that. But there's no debate to be had about whether somebody has the right to life. And there are pro-life Democrats, so, you know, my respect goes out to them. But there's certain tiers or levels for me of, you know, negotiables. But yeah, certainly this is not in any way, shape, or form meant to be a defense of Republicanism or whatever. But yes, like you said, the language has shifted. And that phrase, you can't legislate morality, everybody's probably heard that, and that's such a ridiculous phrase, because all legislation is by nature moral. Anytime you create a law, you're constraining how people behave, how they ought to act. If you speed limit sign on a road that says 60 miles per hour, what's that literally saying? It's saying you should not exceed this. Should not, as moral. As soon as you construct a sentence with should or ought, You're in the realm of morality. And so to say, you know, I'm imposing my morality when I say everyone has the right to life, but you're not imposing your morality when you say, you know, a pregnant woman has the right to, or, you know, ought to be able to choose to have abortion. I mean, that's absurd. That's just hypocrisy. And that should be pointed out to them. You should never let anyone get away with saying, you are legislating morality. Not me, you. No, you should never let them get away with that. So here's where I'd like to get more opinions. Again, I'm assuming we did lose the culture war. And maybe we didn't, because maybe, you know, maybe you think we were never really in a culture war to begin with. Maybe you think that from a theological perspective, since we are, you know, in the world but not of the world, there's a sense in which Christians are never winning the culture war. Those kind of qualifications aside, does anyone have any incident that stands out in their mind that was surprising to them? Maybe in the past 50, it could be in the past 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, where you think you could say that's when Christianity ceased to be the prevailing worldview of at least the United States or the West. Does anyone have any opinion, any comment they want to make on that? Because I don't have an answer. It's just something for you to think about. Maybe some people would say when Roe v. Wade was decided. Maybe they would say when routine prayer was removed from public school, or when Christian bakers could get sued for discrimination, or when premarital sex became the norm. Or maybe you define it in terms of the percentage of professing Christians. And there's problems with all of these, using them as a barometer or a litmus test. I'll get to you in a second. I just, like, for example, when the percentage of professing Christians dropped to a particular percentage, you've probably seen those Gallup polls or Pew Research Center polls that says, like, you know, 10 years ago, 75% of Americans identified as Christian. Now it's 70%. You've probably seen polls like that. I don't really care about those polls because I don't believe that the majority of people responding to those polls are actually Christians. And obviously that sounds judgmental, but I've done enough missions work in the United States to know that people who call themselves Christians frequently do not have an understanding at all of biblical Christianity. It's just, it's a cultural term for them. That was especially apparent about 6 years ago when I went down to Lakeshore, Mississippi with my wife, where there was still some rebuilding going on from Hurricane Katrina, rebuilding of a church, and we would do evangelism, door-to-door evangelism actually, inviting them to a potluck at the end of the week to celebrate the building of this church. And everybody in the South, everybody in Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, everybody says they're a Christian. I mean, their life could be a total disaster and not show any evidence whatsoever of, you know, Christian faith, and they'll still say they're a Christian because that is still embedded in that culture. And what's amazing is it's harder to evangelize to those people than it is to the rank atheist I might have met in New England or something, or, you know, some of my liberal friends I would have met in Pennsylvania. Because at least there was a clear demarcation. Like, you are there, I am here. I'm trying to get you over here with me. That's my hope. That's the prayer. But in Alabama, it's you're not shocking anyone or surprising anyone. Oh, you're a Christian too. Good. That's great. Yeah, well, I can't. I don't really do church. But that's great that you're able to get to. So when the percentage of professing Christian, it could drop to 10%. Well, maybe that's the actual accurate number. Maybe the number is actually like 5% in the United States. I don't know. Anyway, you had a comment on.
Well, I was going to say there have been a lot of little turning points from the 19th century forward.
Mm-hmm.
But a was, one would be the loss of the university by Christian.
That's a good one.
Throughout the latter 19th century, when they start shifting over from a Christian theological philosophical foundation to a scientism, secular, intellectual frame of mind. Mm-hmm. That would be one huge, because they start training leaders of the future.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'll mention that.
And the second one, a more culturally obvious one, was the Scopes Club in 1929. That was a huge turning point in the mind of the cultural leaders, especially when it was put into a movie form in 1960,
mm-hmm.
which was a pure fabrication.
Yeah.
Our fellowship studied the actual trial and then the movie,
mm-hmm.
and the movie is thoroughly ideological.
Mm-hmm.
But huge numbers of ordinary Americans saw the movie. And that told them what fundamentalist Christians were like.
Yeah, those are two great examples, actually.
I think we have to make a kind of a difference between the culture that exists overall in our country as a secular humanistic culture and the culture of the church. Because the culture there, the Scopes Monkey trial, the degradation of the university system, this was all going to happen because of the world. They're in the world and they're going to spiral down. Romans talks about that. But the real issue is the loss of the influence of the church because of what the church in its own culture has accepted,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
allowed to happen. And I was talking to you, and I'll just say, I think Al Mohler makes a good point in his book that it began I'll just throw this out, and you can deal with it as you deal with it. But I believe when the Protestant Church accepted birth control and lost its eye, God's command to be fruitful and multiply, and it all became about having a rich family and a convenient family, and that opened up a selfishness in the Christian home that led to divorce in the Christian home, that led to all the other issues that we have now, and we lost our voice in this culture because we lost our command. And the command to be fruitful and multiply in Genesis 1 is mirrored in the Great Commission, to be fruitful and multiply in the spiritual realm. If one is degraded, then the other is degraded as well. And when the church accepted that and allowed that to exist, we began to see the decay in the 70s of the church and the Protestant church itself.
Yeah, you can go, and then I saw you had a comment, too.
Theological liberalism has a very specific history, and unless we understand that history, we don't understand what that whole movement is about.
Mm-hmm.
And that history is rooted in various interpretations of the scientific revolution and the nature of science.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what the battle was about.
Mm-hmm.
Liberalism bought into certain interpretations of the nature of science and the scientific revolution.
Yeah.
We now know that those interpretations are false, but that's what they bought into.
You're thinking, an example that I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is there's kind of a revisionist mindset even now that the success of the West actually stemmed from the Enlightenment and not the Protestant Reformation,
right.
Which is really, I mean, kind of a myth. It was the Protestant Reformation that touched all of society, the popular level. The Enlightenment was more like an academic thing that I think was even inspired to some extent by the Protestant Reformation. Would you agree with that assessment, or?
I do think that the Enlightenment was inspired by early Christianity, because early Christianity went against Eastern thought. Eastern thought believed that the universe was unknowable. You look at Buddhism and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And because the universe is unknowable, then experimentation isn't needed, and the science dies there. But the Christian mindset that God created us in his image, and Christ came as a man to make us reconciled with God, created thinking within the early Christian church that if God is knowable through Christ and God created the universe, he created us in his image, then the universe is knowable. And therefore, experimentation began out of the monasteries and the wheel and the windmill and all of those things and the shoulder-driven plow rather than the neck-driven plow. All of that transformed agriculture and started the Enlightenment period. That's what lit the fire of Enlightenment, and that came out of the monasteries. It came out of Christian thought. Sorry, I'm excited, but that's the truth of it. So Christianity is on the back front and the forefront of the Enlightenment period, but just like the government hijacked public school system out of the church, so those scientific, early scientific discoveries, a lot of them made by believers, was hijacked from humanism.
Yeah.
And history was rewritten.
Yeah, I agree.
Does that make sense?
Let me clarify. When I say the Protestant Reformation influenced the Enlightenment, I mean in the sense that the Protestant Reformation laid the foundation for disagreeing with the Catholic Church. Not, obviously, the Enlightenment period was humanistic, but it still kind of paved the way for it. But anyway, go ahead.
We now know that there are generally believed that there are two Enlightenment movements. One of them is called the Radical Enlightenment, which is centered mainly in France, and that kind of gave rise to Marxism, materialism, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And there was a more conservative Enlightenment movement, which was more influential in the United States. But that one was still not Christian. It was still predicated on a particular interpretation of the nature of science and scientific revolution, and its philosophical foundation was deism.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we see in the Constitution, that kind of thing.
It's correct to say that Christianity laid the intellectual foundation for the rise of science.
Yeah.
Okay. But the Enlightenment is a non-Christian interpretation.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And then let me get to him. He's been waiting a while, and then I'll come over here to
go back to your question a while back. I've lived in this town almost all my life. And that's a long time.
Okay.
And when I was younger, I remember the day that the major grocery store decided to open up on Sundays, and the Christians were outraged because this man opened his store on Sunday. But once they realized how convenient it was, all of a sudden it quieted down.
That's
a point about the war. I think we're in a lot of cultural battles. That everything I read, especially in Revelations, we win the war.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of why I asked earlier, are we really even in a war we should be concerned about it at all, tying into that eschatology? But that's a great point. You did have a comment, or you?
I don't think it's appropriate.
All right. Okay. We'll just leave it at that.
It's about baseball and how that's not changed all
over. Baseball is basically unchanged for the last 150 years.
No, we have designated hitters.
Huh?
Designated hitters.
Basically unchanged.
So that's a.
The important thing to remain the same.
All right, so the anchor is held fast in that,
right,
that area. Okay, good. So yeah, I don't have a clear answer to give that question. I liked what you said about the universities, and I think probably everyone knows here that institutions like Princeton, Harvard, maybe even Yale, et cetera, they all started out as seminaries. Now, obviously, they're completely godless institutions. Well, Princeton does have a seminary, and I do know some Christians who have still gone there, but it's certainly not a bastion of what we would call biblical Christianity. So we're going to move through this pretty quickly, but does it even matter? And you know, there are some people who... Some Christians who are quite opposed to the idea of a culture war, fighting a culture war, and so those are the questions I want to look at briefly. Are Christians supposed to fight a culture war? Are Christians supposed to be politically active? Are Christians called to redeem culture? You might have heard that phrase, redeem culture. And those on the opposing side would say, no, you can only oppose or you can only redeem people, you can't redeem culture. And the people on the pro side would say, well, you know, that's a distinction without a difference or something like that. And so as an example of the anti-activist opinion, because I've run into a few of these people, they tend to be in more of the fundamentalist camp. They will say something like, the Bible doesn't command activism or give any examples of activism, and Christian activism focuses on symptoms and not the problem itself. I agree with the latter part to an extent. You can be too focused on symptoms of unbelief and not, you know, not focused on evangelism. The first argument I don't really like because it's an argument from silence. It's basically saying the Bible doesn't talk about this or make a specific command, therefore it's unbiblical. That's not really a good argument. You can use that type of reasoning to say no to a lot of activities that I think are perfectly God-honoring. But just because they're not specifically mentioned in Scripture, which was obvious, you know, and Scripture was obviously written in a particular context, one very different from the United States. So the pro-activism opinion would be that the Bible commands Christians to be salt and light, and it's impossible to do this without some kind of activism. And even the anti-activist side, they will at least admit that there's examples of civil disobedience in Scripture. And so, you know, it makes me wonder, well, if that's on a bit of a larger scale, or if it takes a more modern form, like, let's say, protesting or writing to your politicians, you know, is it really fundamentally different? So if you want to share your opinion, you can in a second. But this is my bottom line on kind of the question of does it even matter, is that authentically Christian activism should never replace evangelism and should also never replace legalism. You know, as we go out in culture and we, you know, we say don't do this or do this or whatever, we still have to clarify at some point that, you know, Christianity is not a worldview of just do's and don'ts, and you follow that list and you're a Christian, or you're, you know, you're looked upon favorably by God. And in my discussions with progressives or people who are very far removed from Christianity and have a very progressive worldview, a lot of them are surprised to find that or discover that. Like I was friends briefly, this was like 4 or 5 years ago, in Cleveland with a man who was gay. He's actually kind of, he's very openly gay. He was kind of flamboyant about it, actually. But we had some hobbies in common, so we became friends. I even, we even did some things together on a few occasions, and I got some really great opportunities to talk to him about Christianity. And I remember one conversation he said, so let me get this straight. Christianity is basically you live a moral life and God is happy with you, right? That was basically the gist of what he said. And again, this guy is ultra progressive. That was always his understanding of everything he knew to be Christian, that it just boiled down to this legalistic list. And I said, no, that's not it at all. That's completely wrong. I just told him right out. And I talked to him about grace. And I got the chance to do that on a few occasions. And, you know, it was just new to him. He had just never heard it. So, you know, whenever you do your activism, yeah, it's how do you fuse that with evangelism, or how do you convey the appropriate message? I think you have to develop relationships with people. You really can't put on a single sign that you're holding at a protest, you know, everything that needs to be there to oppose their view and also explain that Christianity isn't legalistic. I think you have to develop relationships, so I hope everyone is doing that. But does anyone have any other comments? Does anyone believe that Christians shouldn't be fighting a culture war, or that the term is misguided, or that anyone opposed political activism? Or does anyone have any comments, thoughts, or you've seen it abused, or you feel uncomfortable with it? Has anyone done any political activism? Has anyone been dragged to jail for protesting Planned Parenthood? I had some friends back in Ohio who had, and they were kind of proud to say that they had been arrested for protesting Planned Parenthood in the 80s or 90s. So I assume most of you vote, so that's in a sense a type of activism. All right, so here, let's get into the reasons of why I think Christians have lost the culture war real quickly. And the first reason, I think, is hypocrisy. And I list this first because I actually think it's the least significant of all the reasons I'm going to give, but nevertheless, it's the most, maybe, it's the one that's in the news most. Does anyone know who that's a picture of? Ted Haggard is the name, that individual. Nobody knows who Ted Haggard is? I guess I'm kind of glad he's not that well known. That's probably the foremost example I can think of the past 20 years of somebody having a notable hypocritical moral failing. I think it happened in 2006 or something like that. He was the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. He was the pastor of a large church in Colorado. And, you know, part of his platform was opposition to gay marriage. He spoke out about that very fervently. And then it came to light that he had been paying a male prostitute for 3 years for, you know, relations. And he, you know, thankfully repented. He left his role as the president of that organization. He left his role as the pastor. And I do not mean to smear him or drag his name through the mud. I honestly thought everybody would know who he was. But the reality is that any Christian's face could end up being there. That's the reality. Every Christian is going to be a hypocrite, and that's why whenever we talk to people, you know, we need to say, this is not about me. This is ultimately about God and His Word, and I am broken, I'm a failure too, and I am not here to say, you all stop being failures, be like me. That's not our message. That's not our message. So I do not stand up here and condemn or wag my finger at him. He knows what he did. It came out. He repented of it. But nevertheless, it stands out as an example. And obviously, believers or unbelievers, you know, used it to mock the anti-gay movement, as they would call it. There's been many other examples. There was another example with the Vision Forum a few years ago. There's another example with Family Research Council, one of the founders of that. And it's kind of been noted that there are a lot of people who are very opposed to, say, homosexual marriage, who also seem to have suppressed homosexual tendencies themselves. And I don't know whether that is because their political war is also kind of a reflection of an internal war they're having. But, you know, I know people who have said, I could never become a pastor, I could never become a leader in this particular area because I think I am too prone to certain sins, I am too prone to disqualifying myself. You know, maybe there's some wisdom in that. So I think more importantly, though, and this is more general, is when unbelievers see just in our daily general life moral apathy and the just little seemingly insignificant instances of sin that erode our credibility. And I'll give you an example of one that I can imagine has happened or I've seen happen is, let's say you're selling a car, and you know the person you're working with, as a Christian, you want to build a relationship with them, you end up inviting them to church, you maybe even share the gospel with them, something like that. But then it comes time to actually create the new title, and they say, hey, can we lie about the sell price so I don't have to, you know, pay that extra tax? And you say, yeah, okay, whatever, doesn't matter. Well, I mean, what have you done in that moment? That's just one example. But imagine that that's how you consistently behave around unbelievers. It's nothing really major. That's certainly not equivalent to being caught in a catastrophic sexual scandal. But in general, when the unbelieving world looks at us, they're going to notice inconsistencies. And that's scary for me because I'm an inconsistent person. So I think that personal moral apathy comes into play. And then also at a more organizational level, something like the Southern Baptist Church, how it took them many, many decades before they acknowledged that, they were kind of the denomination of slaveholding states in the 1800s. And they kind of organizationally apologized for that. But some people said too little, too late. I'm not saying whether those criticisms are legitimate. I'm just noting that organizations as a whole have had moral failings. Not interested in actually talking about the Southern Baptist Church right now. But nevertheless, hypocrisy is one reason I think that we lost the culture war. I do think it's probably the least significant reason of the ones I'm going to mention. I think the other ones we'll talk about are more significant. So imbalance. This is just imbalance in how we approach matters. So for example, I'm just going to give a bunch of examples. Let's say that you oppose pornography, you oppose strip clubs, things like that. But the world sees that you oppose these things, but does it also see that you are supporting safe shelters for abused or trafficked women? Or does it just see you saying no? No to this, but nothing really else related to the problem, lifting it up, helping it. Because the people involved in those behaviors, those activities, I mean, they're very broken people. And if we just say, you're broken, stop being bad, don't do that, are we really approaching the situation in a holistically Christian way? Obviously, we should say, don't do these things, but where's the balance? Where's, you know, just like how Paul says, put off and then put on. What's our put on when we approach certain societal sins or evils? Or you oppose abortion and premarital sex, but do you promote adoption, fostering, and pregnancy resource centers? Do you support single mothers? And that's a criticism if you're involved at all in the abortion debate. You'll hear all the time. You'll hear people say, oh, you care about people until they're born, and then after that, you don't care about them anymore, which is ridiculous. But as Christianity got tied in with certain types of politics, this reputation developed that, all right, as soon as you're out of the womb, okay, you have to take care of yourself no matter how hard the struggle is. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get it together, and, you know, don't be a welfare rat or whatever. You oppose homosexual marriage, but do you still befriend homosexuals? And you might think, wait, I don't see the connection there. But what is marriage ultimately? It's relationship. What is friendship? It's relationship. Homosexuals want to have relationships. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. I think if we had balance, there would be less room for unbelievers to speak poorly of us, and also perfect love casts out fear. I don't have much time, so I'll just go through this really quickly. As I look back over at all the cultural arguments I've heard by Christians over the years, I've noticed that there is not a lot of appeal to God's word. There'd be a lot of appeals to statistics, science, psychology, the Constitution, we're the moral majority, this is traditional, this is what's natural, you're not born like that. But how often have I really heard somebody say, the God of the universe, who determines what is right and wrong and knows us better than we know ourselves, you know, he said this is the way it should be. That's wise. That's rational. How often have we heard that as a final appeal when talking to people? It's like we're afraid to use the best argument in our arsenal, and we wanted to divorce morality from God or Christianity and hope that people just arrived at it by common sense. And then lastly is just apathy. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Romans 12:1 says, do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in the spirit, and serve the Lord. So, do you believe we are in a war? How will you fight? And I like James 1:27 because it reminds us that there's a struggle outside of us and inside of us. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. There is a problem outside of us. There's these orphans, widows, other issues that need to be dealt with, that need our attention. And then within us, there is also a war for personal holiness. Are you tending to just one or the other? And then lastly, I listed some organizations that I think are worth supporting that are in the culture war. But I'll put this up on my website. It'll probably be on the church's website if you want to reference it later. Thank you for the good discussion. And if you have any more questions or comments, we can talk afterward. Let me just really quickly end us in prayer. Lord, thank you for this opportunity to talk about this topic of culture. I pray that you would give us the wisdom we need to help be salt and light, and that when people hear our message, they wouldn't just hear legalism, but they would hear grace, and they would see that we care about them. And I thank you for this church. I pray that you'd keep Pastor Scott safe as he is out east, and also bless Eldon Offutt as he preaches this morning. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.